From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Today, with that smashing defeat of Proposal 1, lawmakers are looking at a pool of money that hasn't yet been part of the road funding conversation. And that's because they're restricted.
I think it's fair that people can look at all the different categories of funds. The challenge is why are they restricted? What's the need in those particular areas?
Then we'll speak with one of the leaders of the Michigan Socialist Party.
50 years ago, the government claimed that they were going to eliminate poverty, that in America all votes would rise when all wealth rose. You have the exact opposite now taking place.
Then how Google figures out who you are, whether they're right or wrong.
Years ago, Google thought I was a boy, like 15 to 24, who liked video games.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Big questions in life. Why are we here? Who are we? Or maybe most importantly, who does Google think I am?
Google thinks you're a cash cow.
I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty today on Stateside. How Google figures out who we are, for right or for wrong.
Years ago, Google thought I was a boy, like 15 to 24, who liked video games.
But first, with last week's smashing defeat of Proposal 1, lawmakers are already looking around for a plan B.
Or really, that should be a plan P, Q, R, or even X, Y, Z, because we have tried so many road funding ideas already.
Hello there, Rick Pluta, my co-host of It's Just Politics. Rick, in a few moments, we are going to talk about this latest, you want to call it a scheme in Lansing, looking at this pool of money, some $20 billion in, quote, restricted funds. But quickly, let's get an update on State Senator Virgil Smith, a Democrat from Detroit, who over the weekend was taken into custody, was arrested. What happened?
Well, it is believed he is suspected of firing several shots into a girlfriend, his ex-wife's car after, some kind of an argument that the authorities are still sorting through. You know exactly what happened, that the Detroit police have asked the Wayne County prosecutor for an arrest warrant, and the prosecutor's office has asked for some more information before they go along with it. But the senator remains in custody at the Detroit Detention Center, and it is believed he is unlikely to show up when the state Senate gavels into session tomorrow here in Lansing.
So Tuesday session begins. Is that a legal reason, or are there some politics behind that?
Well, it's believed that just he is not going to be free and available to make the trip to Lansing. And I'm hearing that in all likelihood, his Lansing office will be closed as well. And, you know, really just everything is kind of up in the air, that people are trying to sort through what happened, what it means, and, you know, a lot of, you know, if this, then that kinds of discussions.
And we should note, this isn't the first time that the senator has had issues with the law. In 2000, he had an arrest for a minor in possession. Mm-hmm. In February 2004, he had an operating while impaired. So this is not his first time with the law.
Yeah, although I think that people would argue that, you know, those are in some respects more mundane, run-of-the-mill encounters that you know many people have and many people get past. And you know, about the time though that, you know, you're charged with firing several shots, you know, in someone's direction at their car, you know, the charge of aggravated assault, if that's, you know, what he is charged with, is a felony. And if he is convicted of a felony, that pretty much means that he has to give up his seat.
When is the last time something like that has happened, that someone, because of a felony offense, has gotten kicked out of the legislature?
Well, it doesn't usually get to, you know, a vote being kicked out. That, you know, the last time would have been State Senator David Jay, who was accused of assaulting his girlfriend, and then just a whole host of other sort of, you know, professional malfeasance, abusing, Senate computers and things like that. he actually hung on and made them vote to expel him. In most cases, it winds up being a negotiation, you know, usually a protracted negotiation, but the elected official resigns before it gets to an actual humiliating expulsion vote. And sometimes the office itself becomes something of an issue in negotiations with prosecutors, that part of a plea arrangement might be that, you know, someone gives up their office. Clearly, we're nowhere, you know, near that point yet. Just historically, that's, you know, what we've had happen when state lawmakers have been accused of major crimes.
Sure. Again, the incident, of course, just happening yesterday, Sunday. So let's move forward then. Let's talk, as we spoke about at the top of the show. And this is this idea of restricted funds.
Yeah, everybody's really waiting for this conversation about restricted funds.
Like, I know.
Let's get to that.
Well, so let's explain a little bit first about where this money is. The details quickly. Hey, lawmakers, they see voters, you know, of course, going, hey, we are not okay with proposal one. So now what happens? They start looking at money that they want to get their hands on. But again, these are restricted funds.
Right. Well, the idea is that before they go for additional revenue, that they'll look for more places in the state budget. And some place that they haven't really looked yet are these roughly $20 billion that are, like you said, restricted. They're designated for specific purposes. They're designated by law. Sometimes it's in the state constitution. And the issue there is the reason it's like that is because a policy decision was made that the public would really like to keep the legislature from doing exactly, you know, what we're talking about, rooting within these funds to play a shell game to use it for something
and
else.
And that gets to some of this sort of the madness of this next idea, right? That if this $20 billion was easy to get to, wouldn't they already have done that? Doesn't this just show that this is, yeah, not even plan like Z. This is plan infinity down the road. You know,
move into other realms of alphabets and
Roman numerals and
numerical systems. Yeah.
Right. And again, I think it also gets to this idea that this isn't what voters want. This is partly why they didn't like Proposal 1, was because some of this money was going to go to different places. A lot of voters
stuff
just saying,
was being moved around.
Right. Hey, well, either raise money, have it just go to roads. And now we're saying, okay, restricted funds maybe go to a child welfare case or veterans benefits or like deer hunting fees, that would now go to the roads?
Well, House Speaker Kevin Cotter said that was where he wanted to look. And he was really, you know, talking primarily about economic development funding. He said that could be, you know, sort of something that runs in tandem. But you know, he's really not getting a lot of love there. Even Governor Snyder has said that he's skeptical of the idea.
I think it's fair that people can look at all the different categories of funds. The challenge is why are they restricted? What's the need in those particular areas? That's the challenge of this, is how do we do it in a way where we don't create harm in some other fashion while we're solving the road issue?
And part of the complication is that not just that the money is designated for a specific purpose, but also when you take out, you know, school aid, which is a restricted fund, when you take out money for hospitals to treat Medicaid patients, when you start looking at revenue sharing to local governments, that there's really not a lot of money, you know, left over to sort through. And, you know, that's why I think that most people are still thinking that this is not going to get done without finding some sort of revenue source, which means that we're looking at some kind of a tax or a fee hike.
And that's what we'll be watching for, as lawmakers now vowing, or at least of some of them saying, hey, quit making any summer vacations or those that you have right now. Maybe re-eyeball those plane tickets. Hope you got flight
insurance. Your timeshare is in jeopardy.
Yeah, because they're actually saying that there may be some special session days to get this road fix done.
Well, we'll see. But I think that first they'll have to get within striking distance a package that they can get approved in the legislature through the House and the Senate. And very likely a coalition of Republicans and Democrats will have to come together to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Meantime, quickly, let's talk about a new Republican National Committee woman for Michigan elected over the weekend.
Right. Replacing Ronna Romney McDaniel, who is the new state party Republican chair. She moved over from that position. And it's Kathleen Bearden, a longtime, you know, state party activist. And probably for most of us, the most interesting thing is who she is not, which is she is not Cindy Gamrat, the state representative and a Tea Partier who has clashed publicly with Lansing's Republican establishment.
Right, recently becoming uninvited to Republican caucuses.
Yeah, and she's been a critic of the House Republican leadership, and she was sort of looking to maybe play a similar role on on the state Republican Party Executive Committee and the Republican National Committee, and the Executive Committee kind of went no way. That it was a three-way race, and after Kathleen Bearden and Mary Whiteford, made it through the first round, Whiteford dropped out and said, she's actually someone. She ran against Cindy Gamert in her House Republican primary and is making noises about maybe doing that again. So, you can sort of look at that and maybe figure out what was what was going on.
And Rick, we should finally quickly note here that the new Republican National Committee woman, as we mentioned, taking over for Ronna Romney McDaniel, who would not say that she thought that the Republican National Committee men, Dave Ajima, should resign after racist, homophobic things, or at least quotes of other people that he posted on Facebook. So it'll be interesting to note to see if and what kind of relationship is created with this new Republican National Committee woman.
Yeah, she has told people that she thinks that publicly criticizing Dave Ajima would probably not be productive, and that she would most likely remain quiet on that.
Although, of course, the governor has former chair of the Republican
Bobby
Party,
Bobby Shostak, Republican National Committee chair.
Yeah,
and that stands where it stands, that the RNC has said that the Michigan Republican Party should find some way to do something about it. The Michigan Republicans have said we really can't, that unless the RNC decides to do something about it. So we will see how future chapters of that drama play out.
Indeed. Rick Pluta, my co-host of It's Just Politics here at Michigan Radio, also the Lansing Bureau Chief, the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick, thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure, Zoe.
Coming up next, we'll speak with a leader of the Michigan Socialist Party.
You have now 39% of the population which is in poverty, and that 33% are in extreme poverty. You would say the system failed.
And then we'll talk to two Michigan writers who just got accepted for a first-of-its-kind artist-in-residency program.
I want to tell a different war story, in a sense. Talk about women, talk about civilians, talk about communities.
That's coming up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. In politics, it seems we talk a lot about Republicans and Democrats, conservatives versus liberals. And later in the hour, we're going to talk about how that affects the way we communicate about issues that affect us all. But before we do that, let's turn away from the red versus blue. And instead, let's turn to Lawrence Porter. He is Assistant National Secretary of the Socialist Equality Party here in Michigan. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi, how are you today, Zoe?
I'm well. So, I don't know how many in Michigan actually know that your party exists. What are you doing? Some concrete ideas here in Michigan.
Well, we've been actually very active in Michigan and in Detroit. In 2013, we did run a mayoral candidate who was a city worker.
Mm-hmm.
His name was D'Artagnan Collier, works for the city water department, and he got a sizable vote. We were involved in the fight against utility shutoffs. We set up an organization called CAUSE, Committee Against Utility Shutoffs. And in the last 3 years, we were particularly involved in a fight against the bankruptcy of Detroit and the water shutoffs that had been carrying out.
Something that I would say a lot of Democrats have also been against in Detroit, talking, about the fact that maybe a bankruptcy didn't need to happen. Help me understand how the Socialist Equality Party might be different in that aspect.
There's major difference. The way it was presented was that the bankruptcy was part of the imposition of a Republican governor, Governor Snyder, who bought in an emergency manager and then took the city into bankruptcy. However, if you examine what took place in actuality, behind the scenes, it was a mutual agreement between large sections of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party to have the emergency manager and to take the city into bankruptcy. President Obama supported the bankruptcy. They also supported the, in a backhanded way, the emergency manager. The mayor at that time of Detroit, Mayor Bing, met with the potential emergency manager candidate, Kevin Orr, before he was bought in. He approved him. He worked with Governor Snyder. This is all behind the scenes. And this is something we brought out in a hearing, an investigative hearing into the bankruptcy.
Lawrence, many will say that, look, Detroit was sort of at its bottom, that something had to be done, something had to be changed, even those who maybe weren't totally for the bankruptcy, but that there needed to be some drastic action. What do you, what would your party have done? Let's say if your candidate for mayor had won. How would Detroit's huge debts and huge issues in terms of blight and crime in the school system, what would your party have done?
Well, the issue really is who controls the resources of our society and how are those resources allocated? If you look at the statistics, the majority of the population in the state of Michigan opposed the emergency manager law and voted it down in 2012 when they had the opportunity, and that was 73 out of 82 counties in the state. That's 89% of the counties in the state voted down the emergency manager law. So that wasn't just something opposed to in Detroit. Mm-hmm. If you look at the economic situation facing workers, you've had now the growth, a massive growth of inequality that's followed nationally down to the local level. And what we were opposed to with the bankruptcy was, in fact, that the reorganization was a part of that redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top. Mm-hmm. What they wanted to do was to eliminate the pensions, which were constitutionally guaranteed of Detroit workers, and also their health care benefits. And the only way they could do that was through the building, through some type of emergency measures. And this is why they carried out the bankruptcy.
Lawrence, I guess... we hear folks talk about this, and I think there is a lot of support, right? Feelings that corporate interests, big organizations, the 1%. I mean, we know if you just look at the economy holding more and more wealth, I mean, it's just sort of mind-numbing how much wealth. Again, of course, we saw the Occupy Wall Street protests. There's a lot of interest in folks like Elizabeth Warren. And yet those candidates, the mayoral candidate, Elizabeth Warren, who's saying, she's not going to run for president, it doesn't seem quite like enough of the population is hearing that message. Why do you think that is?
Well, things change through some time. But I think that what's beginning to happen is that people are going through shocks. You take, for example, the 2008 crash in the economy. Well, most people, of course, didn't expect that. But the major economists did. And they created the conditions whereby the economy crashed in 2008 through massive speculation. Since then, you've had the people who created the crash have been very, very well compensated. You've had the Federal Reserve, the TARP program, which is now flushed money to the top 1% enormously, while the majority of the population has suffered declines. So what's beginning to happen in Detroit, Detroit was a major manufacturing city which had one of the highest living standards of workers in the entire country. Most workers, in fact, own their own homes. This is something that they want out of enormous struggles. What's beginning to happen now is you have now a failure taking place of the entire system. It's really interesting because if they were to say this is socialism, that you have now 39% of the population which is in poverty and that 33% are in extreme poverty, you would say the system failed. But what's really happening is that you have a failure of our system. 50 years ago, the government claimed that they were going to eliminate poverty, that in America all boats would rise when all wealth rose. You have the exact opposite now taking place. Yeah. In order for them to get that wealth today, because of the nature of our economy, it's not the same as it was before with manufacturing. It's now through speculation, through the financial oligarchy and the stock market.
And yet again, what we're getting at is this idea that socialism, right, it doesn't necessarily have the best rap. It comes, of course, with history and some negative connotations. But, you know, even when we talk about President Obama, right, the socialist president, that it's used as an insult and something bad. How do you change that narrative?
Well, of course, we know that President Obama is not a socialist. He's got more support from Wall Street than any other president in history. The truth of the matter is that many young people, especially, are now becoming more and more open to socialism. Polls have shown that the majority favor socialism or some type of social redistribution rather than capitalism. And look at the reasons why. You know, you have now, and I think 35% of the young people today have debts coming out of college of $35,000 and higher. You now have many young people who have seen nothing but wars. In the last 25 years, you've had a constant series of wars. Socialism, what it really represents, is, of course, equality, genuine equality and better conditions for the majority and not based on private ownership and for wealth. Now, the majority of the population feels that way, but they have no say-so. They have no voice. If you were to ask most people, do you agree with these wars, they would say no. You have now one F-35 Strider jet that costs $200 million. It's amazing. You know, Detroit's debt for its water is $22 million. Just stop the production of a fighter jet. You know, you can pay off Detroit's debt 10 times over.
And yet I'll go back to that point, though, that we haven't quite seen that breaking point of, you know, the populace stepping up. And again, like I said, there's the Elizabeth Warrens, of course, you know, Bernie Sanders now jumping into the presidential race. We saw Occupy Wall Street, but it doesn't seem like quite anything is changing. Do you see a tipping point, a point where folks really say enough is enough?
Well, I don't know where the tipping point will develop, Zoe, but one thing is for sure, and is that, you know, there's a reason why they're bringing in the Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warrens. People are now talking about socialism because, in fact, capitalism has not offered and is not offering a way forward for large sections of the population. I mean, you now have, I mean, every day now, young men are being killed, you know, by the police and so forth and so on. It's now becoming a real social problem. And the vast devastation is taking place for the majority of the population. Another statistic I saw said one out of every six people in this country are facing either poverty or near poverty. One out of every six in America, you know, the wealthiest country in the world. So what is the tipping point? I don't know. But you have now, without question, an enormous black eye being given to capitalism. Because if you talk about unemployment, if you're talking about jobs, if you're talking about social decay, then you're automatically talking about capitalism. And that is not a situation where they're offering. Who's offering a better conditions for working people today? I haven't heard anyone. And that's one of the reasons why they're bringing out people like Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is not a socialist. He's a Democrat. He calls himself a Democratic Socialist every once in a while, but they particularly want to bring him out now.
Of course, though, he is an independent in the Senate.
Yeah. But there's a reason why he's now coming out to run, and that is they want to use him as a lightning rod. They need someone at least to give the appearance that something is going to be done to help people. And that's also the reason why they brought out Obama. I mean, he's the first black president. The idea was, for many people, they were given the illusion that he was going to help them. He was going to help create better conditions after the disastrous Bush years and all the rest. But it turned out to be just the opposite. And I think those illusions, those false hopes, are now beginning to look more deeply at what the social conditions, what the social relations really are in our society.
Lawrence Porter is Assistant National Secretary of the Socialist Equality Party. Lawrence, based in Southeast Michigan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
A pair of Michigan poets has just won a first-of-its-kind artist-in-residency program at the Gettysburg Battlefield. The couple, Michelle Bonzac-Every and Rob Every, will spend July in Pennsylvania.
The artist in residency programs are set up for artists to come in and have a lengthy amount of time to immerse themselves in the park and to be free from all the stresses of everyday life and to just create. And it's also set up for educational and creative opportunities for the public. So we're there to write, to take photographs, and to engage the public in terms of the park. We're acting like a bridge between the national park and the public. We're really excited.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to interpreting the landscape and bringing it into a modern context. So we go there and we think about the history of this place and what has happened, but we also have to remember to put ourselves in that and how do we grow from the history of this place and bring it into our personal lives and grow as people and a society.
Well, and that's what I'm wondering. I mean, here you are in Michigan speaking to you right now from Kalamazoo. Why Gettysburg?
You know,
I guess you've been asked that not just by me.
No, it seems a little strange. We're in Michigan. There's Gettysburg. Well, it's part of a national identity, so we do have a connection to it. Rob will talk a little bit about his connection to war, too. But this is such an honor. It's the first – we're the first artist in residence at this park. They just spent time remodeling, restoring this historical house and farm that was actually involved in the Battle of Gettysburg. You know, we lived not too far from Gettysburg for a couple of years when I was an assistant professor in Pennsylvania. So we have our own personal connection to that landscape, too, and the bounty and the farmlands and the orchards in the area.
Yeah, and when you think about it, going off of a national identity, I have two grandparents buried at Arlington who are in World War II. I also had another grandparent, so I had three grandparents in World War II. And I actually had family, the Clark family, who were fighting during the Civil War, some on the Confederate side and some on the Union side. And we have to think about how this fight for freedom has brought us as a nation to this point where we are now, where we're still fighting for some personal freedoms.
Tell me a little bit about how that history works into the kind of work that you do right now.
Well, what I do now is I'm thinking about how war and memory come together and thinking about my place in society, my place in my family, my place in my community.
For me, it has a lot to do with history and women. I mean, I've taught early American literature and women's studies at Western here, and a lot of my poetry deals with history. I've written poems about the Lewis and Clark journey and Sacagawea and trying to represent voices that aren't often heard. So I want to tell a different war story, in a sense. Talk about women, talk about civilians, talk about communities. We are so used to hearing the story from the side of the battlefield.
Yeah.
And this affects everyone. It affects us now. I mean, it affects families. I want to write about the bakers and the shoemakers and, you know, the people writing stories, the poets from then who weren't on the battlefield.
Michelle, Rob, give me an idea of what maybe a normal day while you're there in artist in residence might look like.
Well,
or
I think it's
do you not
change
know yet?
we don't actually know yet. I think we're going to be getting up early. We're going to be taking a lot of pictures because we're going to be showcasing some of our photography as well. Mm. So we're going to walk the grounds. We're going to get out into the community, the orchards, and we're going to just find time to create. And I think having a diverse schedule, because what you write changes by where you are and what you do.
Yeah.
So we're gonna plan to create art in different ways. We're going to take pictures during the day and at night. We're going to write during the day and at night, and it's going to change. We're going to be self-reflective. We're going to figure out the stories and what a lot of these people know who are there and know the history and tell it to the people who come to the park every day. And we're going to just get as much information as we can, enjoy the experience, and try to have a diverse experience within the community and with the park.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when will we get to see the outcome of all of this?
Well, when we come back to the Kalamazoo area, to the Detroit area, we hope to be able to display our photographs in galleries, to give poetry readings. Our website, the Poets Below, where I actually mentor poets, we want to offer a workshop through there and maybe incorporate some of our elements and what we do collaboratively in Gettysburg. So we'll be on multiple platforms in multiple parts of the state. So if you can't make it to Gettysburg to come and see us, you can find us online and in Kalamazoo. And we want to keep working with the public and offering opportunities to create and understand human history.
Well, let's make a plan to talk to you after the artist in residency program is over and see what you've created, see what you've learned. I'm very excited to hear about it.
Be absolutely fabulous, you know, and I have to say this, we are so honored, just let me emphasize, like I'm still in awe over this, about being able to do something like this. It's really rare for artists to be given such an amount of time to focus on their art, and the National Parks Arts Foundation, it's a nonprofit organization funded entirely by donors. The people who are on the board donate their salaries back to the fund to ensure funding for future artists. So it's, you know, there's so much thanks to give, you know, to the soldiers. I mean, to you for having us on the air, to the National Parks Arts Foundation, and to every person who's actually donated and has understood the importance of art in our everyday lives, in community, in this country.
Michelle Bonzek Every and Rob Every, pair of Michigan poets. They've just won a first of its kind artist residency program at the Gettysburg Battlefield, spending the month of July in Pennsylvania. Hey, you two, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Michigan Radio social media manager Kimberly Springer is here. She's going to show us how to figure out just who Google thinks we are. And they're not always getting it right. And then, is the media to blame for how we talk about climate change? That's coming up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark. The more people pay attention to science news as opposed to, say, you know, political news, punditry, the more likely they are to increase their perception of harm about things like global warming. Now, that's not super surprising, right? But at issue here, I think, is the fact that folks aren't paying a huge amount of attention to science news. So what does that mean for all of us collectively in 2015? Saul Hart is Assistant Professor of Communication Studies and Program in the Environment at the University of Michigan. Hey, Saul.
Hi.
And John Besley is Associate Professor at Michigan State University in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences. Hey, John.
Hi, Zoe. Thanks for having us on.
Oh, absolutely. And John, I want to start with you and some of your research that says, hey, basically, scientists, you need to not necessarily just educate the public, but rather engage with them in conversations about issues that have to do with science. Explain where this research is coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. We spent a lot of time studying public opinion about science. In the last little while, we've been focused, just flipped it, and we've been focused on what scientists think about the public and what they think about communication. And this comes out of this question of, well, let's not just focus on how much do people communicate, but let's think about, well, how do we make communication better? And it's pretty clear that the things that make a good conversation better is when you have an actual conversation, when people are listening to each other, when they're being respectful, when they're, you know, not just learning things, which is great, we all want to learn stuff, but we also want to get to know people and try to understand where they're coming from.
And nothing against you two, right? You are in this field. You're studying this. Science, though, not always the most sexy issue, particularly how the news puts things on, talking about maybe sports, celebrities, things like that, you know, crime, things that folks tend to pay attention to. So how do you make science then more compelling, Saul?
I think with making science more compelling, it's a question of finding people that, I guess, individuals connect with. So do you have public opinion leaders who share values or that they respect, and talk to them and finding outlets for them to talk about that issue? And I think John also has done a lot of research on that, so he can speak to that as well.
Okay, John?
So there are things about science that aren't sexy, but there's a ton of things that are pretty cool. In fact, sex is pretty sexy, and scientists study that.
Absolutely.
And lots of things that we care about. I think Saul and I both got into this because we really like the environment. We like nature. I think a lot of people are like us. And so there's lots of things that are related to the environment, that are related to science, that people are attracted to and want to read about or want to see about or hear about.
Yeah, and I should also note, I mean, you know, we're talking here on Michigan Radio. We carry an entire show called Science Friday. We know our listeners are engaged, but I think what I'm talking about is the populace in general. particularly, let's say, cable news, that, you know, it is cheaper to not produce this kind of news. It's sometimes hard to explain. Sometimes there aren't reporters on the docket who even understand all of these issues. So what does that then mean to our overall knowledge?
As you have more limited discourse, oftentimes how science issues then get covered is they get covered more related to political conflict, toward economic issues and things like that. And so that brings in oftentimes contentious voices that speak in opposing ways about these issues. And so oftentimes people will pull to voices that already reinforce the values, beliefs that they already have. So it can often lead to more polarization on critical social issues, whether it's climate change or other environmental issues that are important today.
And Saul, I mean, tell us then about your research. What did you find happen when conservatives and liberals were exposed to more science-based news?
Knowledge generally increased across the political spectrum. Perception of harm generally increased. And harm, whether someone was liberal or conservative, tended to lead to more support for policy to address climate change. Mm-hmm. I will say this was a different finding than when we looked at attention to more political news. With political news, knowledge generally didn't change at all, but especially for conservatives, perception of harm decreased substantially. In that sense, with political news, we had greater polarization on the issue.
Explain why you think that is between the political news and the science coverage.
There's a concept called motivated reasoning, which, as I said before, is people tend to pull information that reinforces the ideas that they already hold. So with political news, oftentimes you have talking heads that are in opposition. Liberals often will pull from a voice that speaks to their values. Conservatives will pull to an opposing voice. But what happens is both are taking information that hardens their views and leads to more disagreement in the public arena with the public opinion.
Which we've talked a lot about, you know, in communication, in media, when you do see things like MSNBC and Fox and the rise of just online, where folks just go and mostly, a lot of times, get their opinions about certain issues reinforced rather than deeper understanding an issue.
Especially as the media structure has become more fragmented, which just means there's a lot more choice. People are both choosing outlets that reinforce the beliefs they already have, but also they're likely to interpret media in that way, even if they're watching the exact same channel.
And the tricky thing, I think, for scientists is trying to figure out how to engage in that. So there is this sort of partisan environment sometimes, and but there's, at the same time, these are issues that scientists care about and spend their lives studying. And so the question becomes, how, as a scientist, do I best get involved in the discussion? And some scientists want to jump right in and really, really maybe even attack the other side and show people that they're wrong. Yeah. On the other hand, we sort of think that there's some evidence that maybe a lot of scientists aren't comfortable with that, and maybe that's not the best technique, that the thing that science is so good at is that sort of reasoned debate and that reasoned sort of thinking through of problems. We're really trying to figure out how should scientists engage and what's the best way that they can do that.
Right, and do they see that as part of their job description, right? Do scientists see public engagement as a necessary part of the job?
I think it's pretty clear a lot of them do, and maybe even most of them do. The trick is, do they have time to do it? Do they have the resources to be able to do it well? And that's where it's really tough. And there's lots of great people around the country who are doing these science communication training workshops where they try to get scientists a little better, but it's still hard. It's hard for all of us to be really good communicators. And we worry a little bit about if there's sort of some communication that might be counterproductive, you know, at the times when scientists, you know, attack or get involved in those political debates in ways that maybe contribute to the polarization. But it would be really great to be able to learn more about how we can try to pull some of that polarization back.
And we were talking about the bottom line earlier. So, I do want to be somewhat self-reflective and wonder, you know, is the media somewhat to blame for this? As I mentioned, producing science and environmental news, it's expensive, right? It's cheaper, easier to produce news about celebrities, the latest sports scores. If it bleeds, it leads. So how much of this is the media not searching out scientists to better explain issues that are of environmental importance?
I mean, the easiest story to write or to produce is this person said that and that person said this other thing and now we have a conflict. I mean, that's the most basic story in the world. And so, yes, it takes some sort of self-reflection, some time to really think of stories that aren't just sort of a conflict. And yeah, I think it would be great if we could find ways to tell those stories. But it is harder, as you say.
So how do we fix it, you guys? let's roll up our sleeves. What do we do?
Well, increasingly, I think there are efforts to actually train scientists in doing public outreach and how to communicate with
the
public.
As John was just saying.
As he was saying, yeah. Because I think that is it's partly a challenge in training is that in academia, while scientists oftentimes have a desire to do that, they aren't necessarily rewarded for that in their career, but also have never received formal training in doing that. And the other thing I think is trying to find connections between the science issues that are critical and also the issues that people spend a lot of time thinking and caring about. So whether that's economic issues or their health. And there is a lot of crossover between these key science and environmental issues and things that people really think about every day in terms of how society is structured and how to create social welfare for everybody moving forward.
Well, and I know that we've seen some research that shows that people start really caring, let's say, about climate change when they notice, you know, that their grass isn't as green or something like that, that sometimes it actually takes that really kind of palpable seeing firsthand how it's affecting your life rather than just seeing it happening, you know, 3,000 miles away or to, you know, someone that you have no relationship with.
One of the things with the science communication training is, you know, trying to make sure that scientists themselves don't fall into that sort of, you know, let's talk about a conflict, that part of being a good communicator is, you know, knowing what you want to say. And sometimes that's making sure that you tell the stories that are about the things that people really care about and not necessarily going down and talking about how this person is wrong or that person's wrong, but talking about the things that, you know, that's interesting, but it's not what people necessarily care about. And good training, I think, is helping scientists do a better job at staying focused on those things.
And the question of proximity, I think, is a really important one. I have a 2012 study that I did with Eric Nisbet at Ohio State University, and we were looking at talking about the health impacts of climate change, whether those were nearby or far away. And we found that when we spoke about that with liberals, it didn't matter. They were on board. Let's do something about climate change. But with conservatives, especially talking about it nearby didn't really shift opinion, but talking about it far away, distant impacts actually decreased support and led to what's called a boomerang effect. And so that's something where I think with these issues, talking about in close proximity, even if there is some opposition, it can help prevent some of that polarization from occurring because everyone cares about what's happening in their own backyard and in their local area. So finding those local connections can have a huge impact towards that end.
And I think it's not just the environment that we see that. It's issues of schools and things like
Absolutely.
That. That if you know, your own kids are in a particular school, you're going to pay more attention to what's going on there than what's going on, you know, in the town next door.
And that local engagement is also key to the scientist side, which is why do we need scientists all across the country engaging? Well, part of it is because scientists are in communities all across the country, and they're the ones who are best in a position to be able to talk about those things at a local level.
John Besley is associate professor at Michigan State University in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences. And Saul Hart is assistant professor of communication studies and the program in the environment at the University of Michigan. Hey, guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty. As individuals, there is a lot to ponder. Questions of life. Who am I? Why am I here? And maybe more importantly, who does Google think I am? Kimberly Springer is Michigan Radio's social media manager. She is here now. Hello, Kimberly.
Hello.
So Google thinks it knows who I am, huh?
Google thinks you're a cash cow. As am I. So Google is looking at our total search history and compiling that into a list of interests. And then they take those interests and they are able to market it to advertisers based on the interests, on any languages you might speak, also on your gender and your age.
Okay, so how is it doing this? And I mean, basically, like, are these just cookies? It's keeping track of what you're Googling, what websites you're going to, what recipes you're looking at.
Exactly. So it's based on your search history.
Okay.
And a question about this was, do you need to be signed into Google for it to follow you around the web? You do not. And that goes for any website. I'm not going to get into the trackers that you can install on your browser because then people have accused me of scaring them around the internet. So we'll skip that part. But after you search something, you're still being followed around the website. So that's how it knows if you've looked at shoes or something on a website, or you've looked at lawnmowers.
Right, because often you'll hear your friends where they're like, oh, hey, I was Googling a new tennis racket. And, you know, then the next day I'm on Facebook. And what is an ad that comes up? It's for a new tennis racket.
It's not magic. They have algorithms to follow you.
How long has this been happening?
I think for as long as Google has existed. I mean, that's their secret sauce, and that's how they make their money.
And so who's buying this information?
Advertisers. So all of the ads that you see in your Gmail or you see in the sidebar when you're searching, those are the people.
So what we want to do now, though, because it's not just Google that knows who we are. You can actually figure out. You can look at what Google has on you.
Right.
So, Kimberly Springer, who does Google think you are?
Years ago, Google thought I was a boy, like 15 to 24, who liked video games. And I have no idea what I had searched to bring that about. But Google has a more accurate portrait now, so it has my age range correct. Languages, it says not applicable. I don't know what that means.
You speak in tech, Kimberly.
Exactly. And also, but my interests, for example, it says bicycles and accessories.
Okay.
I think I browsed for bikes 2 years ago.
Okay.
Before I gave that up. It says that fitness is one of my interests.
Okay.
That could be because I have a Fitbit, an activity tracker.
Okay.
Online video. I watch a lot of TV online.
Yeah.
And then it also curiously says rap and hip hop. I listen to one rap song regularly. Just, you know, when I need a pick-me-up. Like,
sure.
Once a month I'll listen to Rick Ross every day I'm hustling. But I don't think that qualifies as an interest.
Well, okay. So, I mean, it seems like it's got some things, right? Some of your interests. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, it got your age range. Is this really information worth these advertisers spending? I mean, it sounds like it's close enough. Maybe there's some things that are off.
Right. I mean, because I'm sure they pare it down after that and direct, you know, their targeted ads
sure.
to maybe their proportions to these interests. So maybe it knows that I did look up shooter games once. And so it might say, well, she's not that interested in that. So
right.
we'll market more towards, say, finance,
yeah,
which she's interested in.
Okay.
And if you want to help them,
yeah.
you can also edit these interests, but I choose not to do that.
Because you don't want to help Google.
No. Google I just want Google to help me. It's a one-way street. So, Zoe, I think we should open this Pandora's box for you and
you
look
mean
at
right
what
now?
Your interests are right now.
See who Google really thinks I am?
Hot laptop.
You do have your laptop with you.
We're in.
Okay, I'm game. I'm game. Let's do this.
Okay, so, I mean, and the way you reach these settings is that you're in your email.
Yeah.
You go to your settings.
Okay.
And then there's something called ad settings.
Okay.
And so your interests, advertising and marketing, would that be accurate?
And what is that? What is advertising and marketing?
Like, that's the thing. They don't drill down
right.
into these for you. They're very general at this level. But I'm sure for the advertisers, they get much more specific.
Sure.
Enterprise technology.
Well, I don't even know what these mean. I thought I was going to say, like, you know, you're a woman who likes the outdoors. You know, you like craft hard cider. You know, like things like that.
It has. I'm pretty sure it has your age completely wrong in terms of age range.
What do I want to know?
45 to 54.
Oh, yeah. No. So Google basically just, I mean, this is not who I am.
Right.
At least who I see myself. Yeah. You know, I'm at least a couple decades under that.
I mean, I think for your age, for example, I know people will intentionally put the wrong birthday in.
Oh, interesting.
So you can sort of gain the results in that way. Okay, let's look at some of the areas, like the geographic places it says you're interested in, because
okay.
I didn't have these.
Oh, interesting.
Detroit.
Okay. Sure.
San Francisco Bay Area.
I have never been to San Francisco in my life.
Are you trying to go there?
No.
Good.
I mean, one day, but I have not Googled San Francisco, I don't think, recently.
Okay. Tampa Bay Area.
No.
Are you joining a cheerleading squad?
I'm wondering if someone hasn't been using my Gmail account.
It could be.
Has like a 55-year-old woman who really wants to go to Tampa Bay. Does someone want to fess up that they've been using my computer?
With an interest in enterprise technology?
Whatever that might mean. I have Googled plane tickets recently, planning an overseas trip.
But nothing that would go through Tampa Bay.
No.
So, I mean, it can be inaccurate.
Yeah.
But I think it also depends on how much you use the service.
Okay. Well, Google, if you're listening, you know, Google. Just listening.
Out there.
Out there, Google. You got it wrong. So wrong.
now you're going to prompt them to try to make it right. I wouldn't taunt Google if I were you.
That is Kimberly Springer. She is Michigan Radio Social Media Manager, and I am apparently Zoe Clark, looking forward to going to Tampa Bay or San Francisco.
Bon voyage.
Thank you, Kimberly. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Ryan Grimes, Haley Hirschman, and Sid Janwa. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.